This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
What's good, y'all? You are listening to Code Switch from NPR. I'm Gene Demby. So in September, Cardi B and Lizzo dropped a video for their new song together. It's called Rumors.
All the rumors are true, yeah. What you heard, that's true, yeah.
And the song is them joking about all the ways they're discussed on social media, by celebrity news sites, by gossip sites. And specifically, it's about the ways their bodies are discussed.
Last year I thought I would lose it. Read shit on the internet. My smoothie cleanser, my diet. No, I ain't fucking.
For Lizzo, that commentary tends to be around the fact that she's fat. For Cardi, the commentary is about being fake, and I'm doing air quotes, fake, and all the plastic surgery she's had done.
All the rumors are true, yeah. Fake ass, fake boobs, yeah. Made a million ass
boobs, yeah. So the video is this really like Grecian goddess, Mount Olympus sort of aesthetic.
That voice right there that you're hearing, it belongs to Hannah Georges. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic.
And, you know, Lizzo is decked out in gold. She's sort of styled herself as similar to, like, the black singers in Hercules. And she's doing, you know, she's walking around. Cardi's there. She's wearing, you know, not much. She's got some gold paint on. Super pregnant. And they're both sort of trading quips, trading commentary, trading remarks about all of the ways that people have circulated rumors, commentary, you know, vitriol about them and their bodies.
And so after that video dropped, more commentary about their bodies. The criticism got to be so much that Lizzo posted an Instagram live video in which she broke down.
People saying shit about me that just doesn't even make sense. It's fatphobic and it's racist and it's hurtful. If you don't like my music, cool. If you don't like Rumors and Song, cool. But a lot of people don't like me because of the way I look.
All this reaction, all this scrutiny over Lizzo and Cardi's bodies made Hannah's antenna twitch.
I think a lot about beauty as an instrument of power. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Black women are continuously expected to prove via beauty, like, their femininity, right? That is part and parcel of living in a country in which gender is so deeply tied to race, in which womanhood as a category has meant white womanhood.
Hannah says, look, Black women's bodies are treated as unruly, like inherently wrong, in need of taming or correcting. Over the last few decades, though, maybe owing to the cultural dominance of hip-hop, there's been more space to celebrate, or maybe the better word would be commodify, a kind of idealized curvy physique as opposed to the kind of waifish ideal of the 80s and 90s that was associated with white ladies. These days, we love to talk about natural, real, thick Black women as long as they have, like, a 26-inch waist. The thing is, that is a kind of body that, in reality, very few Black women actually have. And even if you do have those proportions, Hannah says that might not be good enough. Cardi B, for example, actually does have what many people would consider that idealized body. At least, you know, before she was pregnant. And as you just heard, she's very open about the fact that it took a lot of cosmetic surgery to get that body, which elicits a very different kind of vitriol for Cardi, you know, for being fake. So if your body doesn't look like this very specific caricature of a Black woman's idealized body, you get called out. And if you make your body look like that idealized Black woman's body, you get called out. So what is it exactly that a Black woman with a body is supposed to do?
On the one hand, I think I understand people's impulse to say to women, like, ignore them. You know, you shouldn't be changing yourself to get men's attention, like, love yourself, etc. I understand all of that. And also, I think that there's something disingenuous about not seriously reckoning with the fact that, like, if you get messages, you know, your entire life, most of your life, during your formative years, etc., that say to be a woman, a Black woman, worthy of love, you have to look this way. It's not unreasonable that that would affect you.
Which might explain why BBLs, or Brazilian butt lifts, are having a little bit of a moment right now. After the break, we're talking even more about Instagram, influencers, injections in the booty, and ideas about what makes a Black woman's body real. Stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Squarespace. Kickstart or update written content on any website, product description, or email with Squarespace AI, generating instant, personalized results that know and show your brand identity. Explain what your site is about, choose your tone, and enter what you need to get short or long-form text. No matter the placement, Squarespace AI makes it easier to go live, stand out, and succeed online. Use code CODESWITCH to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
Jean.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Just Jean for now. Code switch. So I'm talking to Hannah Georges of The Atlantic about her new essay, What Makes a Black Woman Real? And in it, Hannah is interrogating these pressures that Black women, particularly young Black women, are facing in the age of social media. And she does so by looking at the rise of one particular cosmetic surgery. It's a surgery that will be familiar to anybody who's been on Instagram or TikTok at all in the last couple of years. The Brazilian butt lift, or the BBL.
So I read about Cardi talked back in 2018 in a GQ profile about getting just like illegal butt injections.
I was desperate to have a bigger ass. And then almost every girl was going to this lady that was getting the shots in Queens. And it's like, well, give me her number.
She sort of said that she was too skinny to qualify for a BBL because the way that it works is, like, the sort of more official name is gluteal fat grafting. And it's essentially a procedure in which fat gets suctioned from certain parts of the body. Oftentimes it'll be like stomach, back, thighs, and then purified and then injected back into the body, but into the hips and into the behind to sort of create, enhance the sort of hourglass, like Jessica Rabbit figure type type thing.
Mm-hmm. How common is this surgery? Is it common or is it just hyper-visible because of the algorithm, the social media algorithm that seems to be like shooting this like physique, this kind of physique at us all the time?
Right. So I think that social media makes it seem more common than it is, certainly. But, you know, like 40,000 of them were performed last year.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, it's not the most frequently performed procedure, but it is the one that's sort of seen the most rapid rise in popularity over the last several years.
Mm-hmm. And so what people are going for, a lot of people are going for when they get BBLs, is a sort of Instagram influencer proportions. Could you just describe for people who have not seen that what that body looks like?
Yeah, sort of your classic dramatic hip to waist ratio, but, you know, really exaggerated. Like a couple of the surgeons that I spoke with for this story said that it's still common for people to bring Kim Kardashian in as their reference picture, which is really interesting to me, because I think she's someone who's come under fire, got a lot of scrutiny, attention for for people thinking that she's had a BBL, various procedures, what have you. And so it's interesting to me that people bring in an image of a person who we sort of all know collectively is not giving us an unaltered image of herself when she posts online.
So this is what's fascinating about the using Kim Kardashian as sort of a reference point is there's this weird sort of Ouroboros, like, where does this begin and end when you talk about authenticity, right? Like, I don't know if you remember, like, way back in the earlier parts of the Kim Kardashian discourse, like, around the Reggie Bush period, but maybe a little bit after that.
Yes.
A lot of people were talking about her trying to achieve a black woman's body, right?
Right. Right.
And there was, like, not enough interrogation of, like, what people meant by a black woman's body, like, as if, like, that was this, like, universally or, like, widely sort of shared
right.
set of, like, body dimensions, which, of course, it isn't. But also, like, it's interesting because your piece is so much about how it's young black women and women of color who are feeling the weight of stigmatization around getting this body, but they're also using Kim Kardashian as a reference point. So it's like, okay, so everyone is trying to achieve this body that is supposedly a natural black woman's body. At the same time,
right.
nobody involved in this process is, and I'm doing air quotes around natural, but like, and right. I'm not judging that, but like, no one is like, that is not their body. That's not what their bodies are like without modification. What do you make
right.
of that?
And it's been really interesting to think about the fact that surgeons will say, you know, people come in with images that are so heavily photoshopped or, you know, so face-tuned or what have you, that they have to say, like, listen, these dimensions are not possible in nature. Like, this is not physiologically possible on a human being. So, like, let's start from a different place. You know, I'm someone who did not grow up as like a young teen with social media or anything. And so I really, really empathize with what it must feel like to contend with all of those images all the time, right? Mm-hmm. That like how distorted of a view you have, regardless of wanting to, you know, of your own body, if that's what you're consuming all of the time, right? Like we had music videos and like magazines, sure, and TV and film, and all of those things affect younger people's sense of self, all people's sense of self. But it does feel really magnified in a way that's uniquely distorted or uniquely distorted in ways that are accessible to the average person now.
Mm-hmm. BBLs are expensive, and a lot of people who want them get them by going to other countries. Maybe they go to a surgeon that's a little less than reputable, let's say. So part of the conversation around BBLs is that they can be real dangerous. So how is the fact that this is a surgery that we associate with black women, with young black women, shaping how we talk about how safe it is?
Right. I think sometimes it can feel as though people who express concern about the dangers of it are doing so from a place less of concern and more of judgment. That can feel true in some of the tonal, the tone that it can take. You know, one of the things that I thought a lot about as I was working on this is that there are tons of people who get plastic surgery who don't get discussed as examples of plastic surgery because you don't know, because the average person doesn't look at them and know. And oftentimes those are people who've been able to access, you know, like more exclusive or more expensive surgeons, or who have access to sort of social and like commercial capital. And that affects the way that people interact with the idea of surgery or the idea of any kind of cosmetic procedure, really.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you pointed to this viral tweet that was like, you dying from a BBL is hilarious because you could have been alive with no butt, but look at you. And it does sort of capture these two very different things happening around BBLs, which is like on one hand, people with BBLs seem to be everywhere and held up as like this sort of ideal and like use the soul, sell all these products and they're all over popular culture. And at the same time, the people who get them are the objects of ridicule. Like, what is that about?
Well, I think it's that we as a culture don't like to see how women get to the image that we want them to get to, right? So it's one thing to insist that women look a certain way or to say that women are only valuable if they look a certain way. But as soon as we see that women have access to getting there or to quote unquote cheating their way to that, then people are uncomfortable because it sort of messes with their how they're able to assign value.
Mm.
I think that we live in a culture and a country and a society that is also uncomfortable with women's vanity in general. So, right, the idea that women would be altering themselves to look more beautiful is something that people have trouble with, even though we are all comfortable, you know, living in a world where women have to be beautiful to have value. Mm-hmm. So there's this weird sort of paradox, right, that like you do need to be beautiful to be valuable, but we don't want to see all the trouble that you go to be beautiful. It's some of the stuff around, like, you know, men will say like you got to take a woman swimming on your first date so that, like, you know, if she's wearing a ton of makeup it'll come off and you'll see what she really looks like. And it's like, dude, what?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
all right. Of the pictures that you like on Instagram of women are women who are wearing like layers of makeup, even the ones where you think that they're not. So what mm-hmm. are we really doing here? What are you reacting to? Because it's not the actual aesthetic. It's the idea that a woman might be deceiving you and gaining something from you mm-hmm. by using beauty, which is something that, you know, women aren't supposed to use or to access or to wield, but are instead supposed to have assigned to us.
Yeah, straight cis men are such bad arbiters of how and when women are wearing makeup.
Right, there will be all these pictures, you know, that men will post on Twitter or whatever, that'll be woman with a full face, and then, like, you know, then the next picture is, like, her with no makeup on. They're like, this on Instagram, but this in real life. And I'm always amused by people responding, like, did you think that she had orange eyelids naturally? Like, were you under the impression that, like, glitter was on her lips when she was born?
Someone should look into that if that's the case.
Right.
But what you just said about the sort of cheating thing is something we on Code Switch sort of like had a long discussion about, right? Because the cheating conversation, right, like, is the idea that that people are doing body modification, which is what fitness and like bodybuilding and all sorts of stuff is, right?
Right.
It's seen as like legitimate, right? Because it's work, right?
Right.
And you can sort of interrogate like the capitalist undertones of that, right? But it's like work, right?
Oh, yeah.
And cosmetic surgery is cheating. It's sort of like part of this like larger American discourse. But also you can see it show up in a lot of these like Instagram influencers' actual pictures. It's like they clearly have modified bodies and they're also very much like they're often posing in gyms, right? It's like the thing they're trying to convey is that they have actually worked. I'm doing air quotes here. To achieve the bodies they have, because they need to underline that they're legitimate, right? And it's just sort of weird. I guess back to this question about like the way we think about authenticity and realness. Are those even useful notions in this discussion around beauty?
I don't think that they're fair, right? I mean that we can have ethical questions and considerations, like, for example, with influencers who've had surgery posing in gyms or like selling fitness routines with the idea that if, you know, you subscriber use that routine that you will have their body. That to me is like an ethical consideration, much more than one about like whether the beauty is real or authentic, mm-hmm. right? But authentic, I mean, people have been saying that women and especially Black women are not like quote unquote real for any number of reasons forever, right? Like, God forbid you have, you know, a weave. God forbid your hair is blonde. Like, God forbid you've relaxed your hair. Like, there are all of these things that, like, women can't do without signifying that, like, they're not real. And I think that is sort of an impossible burden.
Mm-hmm. Is beauty always necessarily, like, a sort of acquiescence to, like, dominant arrangements of power?
Ooh.
Like, is it about accessing those arrangements of power, or is it about subverting them and upending them? Can it ever be?
I think it's really hard for beauty to exist outside of and separate from power, because so much of how beauty has operated in this country especially has been as a mechanism of control, right? That we have laws that that governed how Black women could wear their hair, right? That to me is like, I don't know that we can live in a country where that is our legacy and move toward a place where beauty can be value neutral, where it can be sort of revolutionary. I struggle with that. And I know there are people who feel very differently and who've sort of made inroads in certain ways. I think one way of answering that question, or one way of at least thinking through that question for me, has been thinking about how often what we see as beauty trends that are subversive, that are seen initially as maybe like tacky or inappropriate or what have you, how often those trends, which later of course go on to become, if not dominant beauty standards, and at least like generally celebrated, how often those kinds of things are signifiers, are aesthetic traditions, are innovations that come from or that are conceived of by trans women in particular, and like Black trans women, low-income trans women, whose relationship to femininity is different from but tied to cis women's. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a coincidence that Black women are continuously expected to prove via beauty like their femininity, right? That is part and parcel of living in a country in which gender is so deeply tied to race, in which womanhood as a category has meant white womanhood, right? And that mm-hmm. that has implications for Black cis women as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, these conversations about BBLs, right, and which are actually about, you know, beauty and power and capitalism and all these things that you're talking about, are often happening in Black spaces among Black people. And one of the things that's sort of chewy about those conversations is like whiteness is not the moral ideal that people are striving for necessarily, right?
Right. Like, it's right. Like, right.
It might, like, there's sort of the shadowy specter of whiteness and capitalism in the corner, but it's not like these are all Black folks pointing to Black folks, Kim Kardashian notwithstanding, pointing to other Black folks as as sort of the templates, right? And even Kim Kardashian is, you know, again, supposedly pointing to some mythologized ideal Black woman's figure, right? Like, there's all of these ideas about Black women's figures and bodies that live in Black people that is part of this discourse.
Yeah. I think what can be a side effect of people understandably critiquing somebody like Kim Kardashian for clearly seeking a proximity to Blackness and like Black visual cultures and cultural expressions. What can happen sometimes when people do that and sort of emphasize that she is trying to look, you know, quote unquote, like a Black woman, is that we sort of repeat and cement views about what it is a Black woman looks like. Right, like because, you know, if she's seeking this aesthetic, it suggests that she wants to look like a Black woman. Then that means to look like a Black woman is to, you know, have a certain hip to waist ratio, right? And I think sometimes what can feel like a defensive negotiation with whiteness can show up sort of intra-communally as policing what a real Black aesthetic, what a real Black body, et cetera, really looks like. Like, in some ways, this reminds me of, like, the really, really messed up discourse of, like, and I think we've moved away from this, thankfully, but I feel like there was a couple years there where it was, like, a pretty big internet thing for Black straight men to either post pictures with or videos of or whatever white women who, you know, were like sick or whatever, and sort of, right, and with commentary like, oh, like, white girls are winning, we don't even need y'all anymore, all that sort of like ugly vitriolic stuff that suggests or sort of explicitly says that like Black women are only valuable because of their bodies, because of a specific a specific bodily asset, right? That, like, we've moved a little bit away from that. And also, so much of what to me feels like policing or rigid or limiting is what happens when Black women's bodies are filtered through the gaze, the desires, the wishes, the wants, the needs and desire for control of straight Black men.
You mentioned, kind of an aside, that there was some stuff you wanted to get into that you didn't get into in this piece. And I'm curious about what did not make it in, because I thought this piece was really fascinating. And also, like, literally, like, the one of, like, some of those elemental things we do is around self-presentation. And that stuff is, like, so loaded with all of this structural stuff, totally. Right? That is often easy to wave away.
Right. We also, like, all want to think that we're individuals and our decisions are coming from just us, mm-hmm. right? Absolutely. And that there's something seductive about that, mm-hmm. right? That, like, when I get dressed in the morning, when I choose how I'm going to show up in the world, I'm doing it to express my sense of style. And yes, but also I don't, you know, none of us live in a vacuum. But some of the stuff that I was thinking about is that a BBL is a kind of body contouring procedure, right? But there are a lot of trans women seeking gender-affirming surgery get these kinds of surgeries as part of that, right? Like, when people talk about gender affirmation surgeries, what they're referring to is either sort of top surgery or bottom surgery. Mm-hmm. And the people access those or people seek those out, and that's true, but that we are so, as a culture, insistent upon women having certain proportions and certain curves and certain sort of BBL body-esque looks that also affects how people police gender presentation among folks who are trans, gender non-conforming, etc. And I wanted to spend a little bit more time sort of talking with folks about what that looks and feels like. Like, there are people who seek out body contouring but who don't necessarily want bottom surgery. Mm-hmm. And, like, what is it about having sort of that hip to waist ratio that feels for some people more affirming than other kinds of surgery?
So we just spent a little bit of time talking about the way this plays out in the lives of some of the people who have had their bodies modified and who are very visible, like celebrities and Instagram influencers and people like that. But what are the implications of this kind of body modification for the people who are consuming these images, like the people who are scrolling on Instagram, you know, like, absentmindedly?
Right. I think it's hard to separate the effects of images of women who've had surgery or procedures done from kind of the broader landscape of, you know, altered images that circulate online. I think that in general, that the, like, Photoshopped, Facetune, altered, however, whether the image or the person, often both, those kinds of images, like, have incredibly detrimental effects on young people in particular. There's been, you know, so many studies about how social media affects teens and especially teen girls' mental health. There was a pretty recent one about how Facebook in particular has known that its platform, including Instagram, has been detrimental to people's mental health, and just to sort of, you know, kind of thrown their hands up and been like, well, it is what it is. And that's something that came up a lot in my conversations with therapists who see a lot of women, who see young Black women, who talk with clients about, like, body dysmorphia, about sort of body dissatisfaction, that social media tends to be a pretty consistent through line. And that, again, it's not as simple as saying, well, like, log off. And that often the remedies that people who don't experience this themselves suggest to girls and young women are quite condescending or sort of don't capture the root of the issue, which is that you can't unplug from all of life, all of the inputs that come in this way, and that women or young girls should be able to have access to community and to expressing themselves online and, you know, in the real world, in the non-digital world, without having to consistently be brought down by images that are designed to be false and yet, you know, take on a sort of reality of their own.
Hannah Georges is a staff writer at The Atlantic. We've been talking about her article, What Makes a Black Woman Real, which y'all should check out. Hannah, thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule to rock with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, y'all. That's our show. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at NPR Code Switch. We're on IG at NPR Code Switch. Email is moyabag. Ours is codeswitch@npr.org. And subscribe to the podcast on NPR One or wherever it is you get your podcast. This episode was produced by Leah Donnella and Jess Kung. It was edited by Leah. Shout out to the rest of the Code Switch Massive. Karen Grigsby-Bates, Kumar Devarajan, Alyssa Jong Perry, Sam Yellowhorse Kessler, Christina Kala, and Steve Drummond. Our art director is L.A. Johnson. I'm Gene Demby. Be easy, y'all.
A special thanks to our funder, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, for helping to support this podcast.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.